Welcome to Nell and Matt's Obsolete Movies, the podcast where we revisit movies from our 20 plus years of collecting films, watching films, doing all the thing with films, and specifically on obsolete formats. Another way to think about this podcast is this: on this podcast, we review films from the VHS era, though not necessarily on VHS. And our film for this episode is Phantasm from 1979, and we have it on a slightly warbly VHS tape, getting it from Pleasant Dreams Records in Polish Hill, which is a place that sells VHS in Pittsburgh. Yeah, Phantasm. Where should we begin?
Well, at first I can't express how wobbly it was.
It was, yes.
This is where...
Wavy, yes.
This is the problem with VHS, is that it can be very wobbly.
Yes, this one was a little... The adjusted tracking and...
We have a fancy VCR that has tracking on it. And it just, yeah, like, it seemed like every five minutes the auto tracking popped on to deal with the wobbliness.
Yeah, this was a loved and abused tape.
It was a very loved and abused tape.
Yes.
Well, I think Phantasm, I think maybe the first thing to think about is the name, right? Because a phantasm can mean imaginary or illusion, or can also mean a ghost or haunting, right?
Clever.
So, the director and writer of the screenplay is kind of already putting out there that there might be something more going on than we realize. But where would you like to start? Would you like to talk a little bit about a synopsis of the film?
I guess we should. This is one of those where, you know, movies we don't think a lot of people have seen, we want to start with a little plot summary so people can follow along. Not sure about Phantasm. You know, it's the RC Cola of 80s, 70s and 80s horror franchises. You know, there's kind of Halloween, there's Friday the 13th, there's Nightmare on Elm Street. And then Phantasm, which is also a franchise, which became a franchise.
Yeah, and it cost $300,000 to make, but it made over $20 million. So
yes.
You know, on that type of return on profit,
there's gonna be more sequels. Phantasms.
But I think it's one of those things where it's from 79, so yeah. You're like, how many people
watched it? And also, we'll get into the way that this movie is perhaps delightfully broken.
Yes.
So the plot, there's a kid and his older brother. Older brother is 20-something, kid is maybe teen, preteen. There's a creepy funeral home, there's a creepy funeral director, and there's some dead parents and some trauma, and then there is this an ice cream man and this dreamlike excursion as they realize that the funeral home and the funeral director isn't quite right.
Exactly. The tall man.
The tall man, played by Angus Scrimm, who we found out the other night was also in Chopping Mall. I have no idea Angus Scrimm was in Chopping Mall.
He was in the very beginning of Chopping Mall.
Yes.
And who knew?
And who knew? And how much more plot can we give without giving it away? And also, how much more plot can we give without sounding like sort of like the 12-year-old that explains a movie plot sometimes, and then they went into the spaceship, and then they went into the thing, and like, because this movie meanders
a lot,
and there are nightmares inside of nightmares,
yeah,
and you're not really sure at the end of the movie if the whole movie was a nightmare, or there's several planes of reality and existence happening within Phantasm, get into all of them, we try to keep this podcast 30-40 minutes. I think we could just retelling Phantasm 30-40 minutes. But let's just say those basics. Kid and his brother, older brother, scary funeral home director, funeral home that doesn't seem quite right, small town America,
yeah,
that doesn't seem quite right.
Right.
Which is also one of the fascinating angles of this movie.
So the brothers are Mike and Jody. Mike is the younger brother. Jody's the older brother. And Reggie, the ice cream man, is the best friend of Jody.
Yes.
So those are the three prominent characters on top of the tall man, who is the funeral director. And for this particular podcast, we have some guests.
Sorry, that growling in here is not a clever special effect. It is our two dogs, Libby and Hildy, deciding that now is a wonderful time to wrestle.
And in where we do our podcast.
Yes, in where we do our podcast with a sensitive piece of...
The lady in lavender is also another character that pops up.
Yes.
So, you know, at the beginning of the film, there's a funeral for one of Jody's friends. Mike doesn't go, and he kind of... That's when his suspicions of the tall man start emerging. But what we find out is that Mike and Jody's parents died in a car crash, and Jody is now raising his brother, Mike.
Yes.
And so Mike starts to believe that there's something very strange with the funeral home and the funeral director.
Yes. Which there is.
Yes.
But I think, well, let's get into it for me aesthetically. I mean, again, this is a movie where, actually, Roger Ebert, I just read his review from when it came out and talked about, you know, he has a list of great moments in bad films. Mm. You know, if you're looking for plot, but the aesthetic of this film, and I think, as you mentioned, this film was made for $300,000. Apparently when it was first test screened, it was 15 minutes longer. There was a lot more character development. There was a lot more exposition, and people hated that. Which is also this movie that does a really great, amazing job, almost like with Clerks, of making virtue out of necessity.
Yeah.
They didn't have a lot of money. There was also, I guess, looking at some of the things I read online, production notes, there were scenes that they shot that weren't exactly scripted. Mm. They would make the dialogue up in real time. Like, kind of, we're going to shoot this scene, and this is what you need to say, and this is what you need to say. And, you know, so some of even the dialogue is sort of improvised. Oh. And the way that the movie gets chopped up in editing does give it this really profound, surreal, dreamlike quality.
Yeah.
And if you just let yourself get sucked into that, and you let yourself get sucked into, there are these sort of elements of the American Gothic. The funeral home itself is something right out of a mid-century Edward Hopper painting.
Yeah.
So it uses that visual vocabulary. There's also, you know, this notion of the American pastoral or the small town America where nothing bad is supposed to happen.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
The promise of the new world and how we tend to see ourselves as a country, or we did see ourselves as a country after World War II. You know.
Hey.
Sorry, the dogs are very rambunctious.
They're... To add on to that note, there is the house is this like really nice split level, you know, rancher house that's in a nice cozy little neighborhood that you would never expect something bad to happen in. In a way, it kind of reminds me of Poltergeist, where it's just like these nice little homes and nothing bad should happen in this type
yes,
of
exactly.
neighborhood.
Yes, exactly. The American dream / nightmare aesthetic, which is, I think, again, really fascinating about this film. And I think if you are a Gen Xer, there is a weird nostalgia about it.
Yeah.
You know, and you remember things kids did. I mean, I can't imagine my students riding a dirt bike through a cemetery.
Yeah.
But yeah. One of the first scenes in the film, Mike is riding a dirt bike through the cemetery. When I was like, oh, kids did that, you know.
It's also fascinating because, I mean, granted, the parents were killed, but it's like devoid of adults in some ways. Like
yes.
A lot of it is just kind of like Mike experiencing what Mike is experiencing. And his brother is probably not that far into adulthood himself.
No, he seems to be in his early 20s.
Yeah.
And I mean, I guess this is the other sort of Gen X nostalgia thing about this film for me, is having grown up in a small town, which was supposedly a very good place that people were supposed to grow up. But you knew, even as a kid, there were weird people.
Yeah.
And there were weird things.
Yeah.
that happened in that town that were always sort of on the edge of the experience. It's almost what I wanted from the first part of the It remake.
Yeah.
I thought there was a moment about 20 minutes into that movie that they were going to get into, oh, wow, these kids are sort of like becoming aware of the evil in their idyllic small New England town.
Right.
And these experiences that are on the edge of, you know, the polite American dream idyllic town. And in a weird way, Phantasm does that for me.
Well, you know, he feels right around that age of like 12, 13 where you start noticing those differences. And everybody knows that there was like a house in the neighborhood you didn't go to and mm-hmm. that there's people in the neighborhood you don't talk to. And like if you're by yourself, take this street, not this street, because Jack lives on this street and Jack's can kind of be weird at times.
Yeah.
And so you're like 12 or 13 when you start noticing that because you are, you know, especially in the 70s and 80s when we grew up, you were allowed to roam around by yourself and there weren't people there to make sure you're okay. And so you kind of had to talk to each other and figure out and navigate spaces.
Yeah, and you know, for me, I mean, I grew up next to the town weirdo.
Yeah.
Well, actually, our town had several weirdos, but maybe the weirdest weirdo lived next door.
Right.
And, you know, I had to grow up kind of quick.
So Mike is learning like that there's something about his neighborhood that just doesn't feel quite right.
Yes.
But it is like this really cute neighborhood that you would love to live in. And it's an adorable house. And,
it's the American dream.
It's the American dream.
Except there is profound, radical, supernatural evil happening. And it is almost also the profound, radical, supernatural evil. I mean, there's the giant floaty ball thing that'll...
Everyone knows. I think if you don't really know Phantasm, everyone knows the sphere.
Yes.
The silver sphere that flies through the air and latches onto people's heads and drills in. Like, everyone knows.
Yes, and if you haven't balled up a piece of tin foil or aluminum foil and thrown it at someone and yelled Phantasm, you really haven't lived. You know, you're missing out on one of life's essential experiences. Yeah. Sure, sex is great, but have you thrown a tin foil ball at someone and yelled Phantasm? And you know,
yeah. So that definitely has made it into like the American lexicon and the American culture is that sphere. So even if you have not watched Phantasm, it's been referenced in other films, and so it'd be a shock if you were like, oh, a sphere that can kill you, Phantasm. Like that's exactly where it came from.
I mean, there's also sort of elements, like I said, about the chunky plot that you just think like. They did come up with almost like a film like The Conjuring that does try to hold together and is all just jump scares every like 10 seconds.
Yeah.
Phantasm does have this element of like, oh man, wouldn't it be creepy if you like your parents are dead, but then you went to look in their coffin and there was nobody in there and what was happening and what happens after you die is not heaven or hell, but like you get taken to another planet or something. You know what I mean? Like there is this element of, you know, and there's these like orc things and things
these demonic dwarves.
These demonic dwarves and, you know, yeah, and super creepy funeral home directors and mausoleums and all of those things that are like just generally creepy. Let's put it all in a movie.
Yeah. So the first time I saw this movie, I was not a big fan of Phantasm, to be honest with you, which is not a huge fan of it because it is all over the place. And also, so there is an alien element to it, so...
Alien element
to it. So supposedly what, like, the tall man is doing is taking the dead bodies, shrinking them into dwarves, and sending them as slaves to another planet. I'm not a huge sci-fi alien fan, and so when I saw that movie, and it veered from her into, like, the sci-fi thing, I was like, ugh. But, you know, we revisited it a few years ago when a good friend of ours was out visiting and a local movie theater was showing it. We went to rewatch it, and I actually really enjoyed it much more at that time.
Yeah.
The part I really like about it is, like, much like The Babadook, it is an exploration of grief.
Yes.
And I think that's the part of it. Like, when you're, you know, I was probably 10, 11, 12 when I saw that movie the first time. You're just like, okay, there's some scary parts. But now as an, you know, older looking at it and thinking about a 12, 13-year-old boy whose parents were killed in a car crash, how do you process that grief? And how do you make it through? that's fascinating. I think that's a huge fascinating element of the film that really is focusing a lot on grief.
Yeah, and I think it's also, for me, if we talk about, you know, I talked about visual vocabulary and, like, cinematic literacy, just having to watch a lot of movies. When you watch a lot of different kinds of movies, mm-hmm. I think it sometimes allows you to view, I mean, and I think about this, like, some of the work I do in a classroom and you know, when I've taught film studies. You know, I think there's an element to, you realize that there are certain films you just meet on their own terms and mm-hmm. meet in certain ways. And if you're looking for something that is conventional, plot-driven, that every scene makes sense, the Phantasm's not the movie for you if that's what you're looking for. But if you meet it on its own terms as this maybe, subconscious exploration of this dream state,
yeah,
or whatever, when you meet the film on those terms, there's a lot of really interesting things that happen and really an aesthetic that you can sink into. And I would even go far as to say, and now this was maybe my, that time with John was the second time I've seen Phantasm, mm-hmm. and now we're probably up to 4 or 5 viewings of Phantasm.
Yeah.
I like the movie a little more every time I see it.
Yeah, I think I'm gonna say Ravenger. We did see Ravenger. I did not like Ravenger.
Yeah, I mean, the sequels, whatever, they're sort of making stuff up. You know, they should never gave those people money to make movies. I don't know.
If you take it as a film that it's a little boy, it's a boy trying to come to terms with his parents' death, and then you find out actually later at the end of the film that his brother also dies. And yes. So,
and he's afraid of that separation, and that if you've been through that kind of grief and loss, what does it mean to love anyone or want to hold on to anyone or anything ever again?
And if you have 3 people who you love taken from your life and you don't know why, right? They're both they're all both accidents. You try to find reasons for it. And in his subconscious, it becomes the reason is the tall man. The tall man is out to take his family away.
Yes.
And so in that sense of, like, coming to terms with that grief, like, how amazing is that? Like, what a beautiful exploration of him coping with it. But then also, you know, I think we all, when you're faced with grief or trauma or difficulty, you want to be the own hero of your story.
Yeah.
And so he also becomes the hero of his own story.
Yeah, and he has his buddies. He has his brother. He has
his brother's friend.
His brother's friend, friends, the ice cream man. Yeah. And that, wouldn't it be amazing for something like that you can't solve and you can't fix to be able to fix it?
Yeah.
And that's a very, human and humane thing.
And I think, you know, as I said, the first time I saw it, I didn't like it because I felt like it all went all over the place. But if you take it as it's a dream state, and it's surreal, and dreams don't make sense,
then
kind of like his journey makes sense. Because there's even the scene that for me never makes sense of him going to see the psychic old lady.
And the hand in the box.
A la Dune. Like Dune has this hand in the box thing.
Yes.
He puts his hand in the box and, you know, it gets trapped. So he goes to this psychic and you're like, why is he going to see a psychic? I don't get it. He's following his brother, stalking his brother literally everywhere.
Yes, but even when his brother drives somewhere, somehow he's able to follow the car.
Yeah.
And not be completely winded and exhausted, even though they go to the roadhouse on the edge of town.
And it's a dream. So if it's a dream, that makes sense that he's capable of keeping up with his brother wherever he goes. And so these kind of bizarre things happen. It's disjointed, much like dreams are.
Yes. And I will say, too, to watch it in an era when it feels like every aspect of American public life kind of hurts, and everybody is dumb and weird and potentially violent. Again, I think it is this weird exploration of America seeing itself as this post-historical. Nothing bad could ever happen here.
Yeah.
Which we sort of lost that, and I kind of miss it, though it was naive. There is that element. And so one of the ways that I was thinking about, and I will not be able to pronounce the painter's name, but you can Google it, people, is I look at Phantasm as sort of like the Renaissance painting Madonna with the long neck.
Mm.
There's a painting, famous painting of the Virgin Mary, with a super freakishly long, not quite giraffe, but substantial neck. And it's known as the Madonna with a long neck. And in this weird way, in being broken, it's quite beautiful. Mm. And I think, in a way, Phantasm, for me, is Madonna with a long neck, the horror film.
Yeah.
Where in it maybe even because of its flaws.
Yeah.
It's this really tremendous picture.
Yeah. And you think for Don, the director and writer, Don... Coscarelli, I think is how you say it. He also did Bubba Ho-Tep.
Yes.
I'm a big fan of Bubba Ho-Tep. I would probably argue the better of the films. I'm a bigger fan of Bubba Ho-Tep.
Yeah.
He also did Beastmaster. And so, like, Phantasm is really his kind of stamp on the world. And he did...
Is his foot in the door?
Five different Phantasms. I've seen Phantasm 2, maybe 3, and we did see Ravager. And so Phantasm has been his stamp on the world. And this is his film that he's famous for. And... That's what he's known for. So it does have these elements that are beautiful about it, but it is certainly a flawed film.
Yes. And it is surreal, and it's got action, and... I mean, there are also, I will say, again, if you want to enjoy it like a painting, there are scenes in this film that are just so aesthetically pleasing.
Yeah. I will say the ones... Well, you know, we'll get into the questions, because we'll talk about kind of... technology and things like that, so I'll save that thought.
You ready for the big four?
Yeah.
All right, the four big questions. Question one, is it camp, retro, classic, or just an old movie?
What do you think? I always get stuck on this one.
I think it's a classic. Okay. I think it's Madonna with the long neck. Mm-hmm. You can't go back on that. For me, it's a classic. I think for me, and maybe this is Gen X generational narcissism, again, I don't know if older folks would think of Phantasm. I don't know what younger folks would think of Phantasm. But I think it hits just right for someone our age.
I think
it's a Gen X classic.
It's a cult classic for me, right? Like, I think in that sense of it's not necessarily a highly successful film for me, like, but there is elements that I enjoy about it, and I do think it's a film that people should watch.
Yes. Question two, what about the social political distance? You know, the Bechdel test, the representation of race.
This is a very male film.
Yes,
but
it
in
is.
A good way. Like, it's not Porky's. It's not like the male gaze looking at naked women all the time.
Yes.
It's a very male film.
It's a very buddy bonding film. Yeah.
And so I think it's, for, you know, as a woman, when I first saw it, like, I mean, it didn't connect with me because it is very much a boy
masculine
film.
World.
It's
yeah.
very much a masculine world. And then the women who are in it, like the lavender woman, the woman in lavender is like a succubus type of figure.
Yes.
Who's trying to lure men in and kill them. They have two female friends who kind of help out, but they're just kind of...
Plot devices.
So women really don't inhabit...
Exist in this world, yeah.
This world. It's a very, very male-centric film.
But I think I think the male friendships and the male camaraderie is very positive.
Well, I think it's also beautiful in the sense, like, we don't really talk about male grief either.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's okay. Like, let's take Steel Magnolias. Like, that was okay. Steel Magnolias is all about female grief and loss of a daughter. Everyone's crying. Everyone's freaking out. The whole film. We don't get a lot of film where it isn't male grief, and you're seeing something through the lens of male grief.
And you also have these male figures. The adult male figures do... take on these caretaker roles.
Yeah, even Reggie the friend
is a caretaker
who wants to make sure that this boy's okay, that Mike is okay. So in that sense, like, though I say I don't mean it in a like kind of way, like it's frat boys, you know, smashing cans on
their
heads.
It's not Animal
naked,
House.
Naked
it's not Porky's. There is a profound masculine camaraderie.
And
masculine grief. So what about question three, the technical distance in terms of effects or whatever, or also known as the room test?
Yeah, I mean, some of the effects are. So even the spinning orb is kind of like a little lame in a way. Like, now that we have the big
screen. The finger in the box.
The finger in the box is a bit lame.
The mustard blood.
The mustard blood. That, now, I think the tall man was definitely creepy.
Yes.
I think they actually did it anyway. Like, literally.
And excellent use of fog machines throughout.
Yeah. Like, even if they just get put him on platform heels, and the acting of
Angus Grimm is so good.
So good. Like, the tall man.
Game boy, but now you die.
Boy. The tall man is just amazing, amazing. Close up of the dwarves aren't great either. So if they just kind of kept the hoods on the dwarves, yeah, it'd be okay. The one thing that actually kind of struck me this time is that so it's kind of interesting. The way the portal from the two worlds opens up is through vibration.
Yeah.
Which actually was kind of a cool concept for the day.
Yes.
The use of vibration. That kind of stuck with me this time. Like, oh, that is kind of cool, because you think of, like, the speed of light and the speed of sound. Like,
yes.
Oh, the kind of the portal is related to sound.
Yes.
It was actually kind of fascinating. Yeah. It was really fascinating. But, you know, that's definitely, you can definitely see the effects have not aged.
Well, but also in a weird way, maybe because they did not have much of a budget even for the practical effects.
Yeah.
I think, again, for me, the weirdness, the creepiness is in the storytelling and is in the acting, which always impresses me more than, you know, it's why we will always want to watch the German film Requiem, which is the same story as The Exorcism as Emily Rose. But The Exorcism of Emily Rose is an effects-driven movie.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot of character and not very good acting. Whereas Requiem, there are no special effects.
Yeah.
But the acting is absolutely exquisite and creepy.
Yeah.
And then again, this is a film, this Madonna with a long neck film makes virtue out of necessity again and again and again.
Well, I think that, you know, the Angus Grimm character is really creepy. Like, I think that tall man is generally a creepy figure. And he actually probably really didn't need a ton more beyond the tall man, because he was kind of messed up. And the demonic dwarves, whatever you want to care, you know, like, them kind of scuttling around in the dark was kind of scary.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't really need close-ups of them, because them in the dark was just actually kind of creepy enough.
Yeah.
And then, of course, being in a mausoleum and cemetery in the middle of the night is scary enough in itself. But some of the effects didn't hold up, but there was definitely elements of it that were very scary.
Yes. So the final question four, is it a keeper?
probably shouldn't keep this question anymore. I think it's a keeper. I would not.
Yeah, maybe we need to rephrase
this.
Will we ever revisit this? Actually, that's a new question for. Will we ever watch this movie again?
Yeah, we will watch this movie again.
That's the new question for.
We will watch this movie again. I wouldn't watch the other ones. I will say, because Ravenger takes it to the alien side, just says it's not kind of. When you think about it, just explodes the whole, like, dealing with grief, because hard on for the aliens.
But, man, the first Phantasm, and, you know, I bought this VHS tape. We own this movie on DVD. I bought the VHS because I wanted to do this podcast. And I will watch that DVD. I want to watch that DVD every autumn.
Yeah.
Every September 1st is the beginning of spooky season. I want to watch it some point in the 61 days of Halloween.
And we are officially in spooky season. Our rest of our podcast will probably be a spooky podcast. Because we can't help ourselves. It's time of the year.
Yeah.
But I will definitely rewatch it again. It's a really good film. It's a really sad film, actually, when you think about it.
Yeah.
I'm a person who always gets into that story. The personal side of the story.
Yes.
And at the core, it's a really sad story of a boy who's lost his parents and his brother, and has lost his place in the world and doesn't know how to deal with it. And that's the core of the film. And it doesn't get much sadder than that, right? And so everything else that kind of happens in the film is really about this dream state of him processing all of these losses. And so it tries to be scary, but at the core of it, it's a really sad film.
But there is some nicer. There are some nice, creepy moments.
There are. Absolutely.
And on that happy note, we're good.
All right, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.